Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Today is our second anniversary of starting the magazine, so congratulations to everyone at WOOC and WOOS. I'm Mark Dunlay.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Yes, indeed, congratulations. Well, we start off with a report from the panel last week on the Green New Deal.
18 years ago, more than 3,000 people were killed by four hijacked airplanes. We will take a few minutes to reflect on what has happened since 9/11 and what are some of the remaining questions and challenges from the attack.
Afterwards, we'll have our weekly food diary about sourdough baking. And we finish up with an interview about justice for Edson Thevenin and the protests at Troy's recent mayoral debate, followed by Willie Terry's coverage of the Albany Labor Day Parade.
But first, tonight, as we mentioned, it's the second anniversary of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and we're joined by Steve Pierce, a co-founder of the Sanctuary for Independent Media and WOOC. So, Steve, how do you feel about getting 2 years under the belt here?
It's incredible. Everybody we talk to about the idea of running a volunteer-based daily news show said that it was impossible. Can't be done. Not so much that you can't start it, but it's very difficult to sustain. So we're thrilled to be here 2 years later.
And it's obviously being sustained because you have programming out 5 days a week, actually.
It's a bumpy road. There are days when it's hard to do it, and there's some days where everything comes together, and days like today where there's more material than we can use. So it's gratifying. It's a challenge, but that's how we know we're alive.
Why did you decide to start a radio show?
A radio show?
The radio itself program, Hudson Mohawk Magazine, is 2 years old today. So why did you decide to do this?
To start the news show.
Mm.
Well, it wasn't just me. There were a number of people who worked on it. I should note Dan Lyles and Elizabeth Press, who did a huge amount of the early development work on it. And, of course, you know, probably 50 to 100 volunteers at this point over the past 2 years. But I think the key reason we did it was there's a huge void in terms of what's available to people in the media about what's happening in their very own backyards. Mm. Huge amount of mostly misinformation and disinformation about what's going on around the world, but almost nothing about what's happening locally. So there's a void, and that's an opportunity for a station like ours and stations like ours all around the country.
Well,
how has the community reacted to the magazine show so far?
Well, you know, that's difficult to say. I think that the reaction, this is always a challenge with broadcast media, and particularly with radio. You don't really know who's listening. The rating services that are out there are designed to measure mass audiences, and low-power FM stations don't have mass audiences. So the margin of error in ratings is greater than the listenership or viewership of endeavors like this. So you deal with anecdotal evidence about the impact. And so we know that there's an impact because people tell us that they've heard things on the radio. People tell us that they want to come on the radio to talk about what they're doing. So there's an ecosystem that's clearly working on the level that we want it to work. We want it to be, we're not looking for mass numbers. We're not looking for huge audiences. We're looking for meaningful impact in the community, having people come here and talk about what they're doing and have people come here asking questions about what's happening. And so I think from that perspective, it's been successful. And just the fact that people remain involved on a volunteer basis shows that it's successful.
I have a question. Today is 9/11, and you started 2 years ago. Was it intentional that you were making a political point or a point about media by starting this particular show on 9/11, or is that coincidental? Or
no, it's not coincidental. The development for the show happened in the summer, so we were looking for a fall start. But the most significant date in the fall is 9/11. And for me and many of the people who I work with, 9/11 is a pivotal moment in our lives, not for the reasons that you hear on the anniversary in corporate media, but because it's, well, like everyone, it's changed our lives and in a way that would have been unimaginable, I think, 20 years ago. the way that media is being used to divide people, the way misinformation and disinformation is spread all over the world. It's exacerbating the problems that we have rather than solving them. And so for us, I think the folks who are working here are dedicated to creating and maintaining a platform where human beings can talk to one another about the real problems of the day at a local level, certainly, but also nationally, and help folks who are here working locally organize and spread truth about what's really happening, what Americans are responsible for doing around the world with their tax dollars as a result of not paying attention to what's being done and by whom. And these are all things, they're not, you know, I think there's a feeling there's not much that any of us can do to change the situations in the world. But the fact is that we are all responsible for trying to do something. And so on a very small level, this is what the radio show is about, the radio station. And I think there could be no more significant time to do it and to start doing it than on 9/11.
Now, I know every night we ask for more volunteers to join the radio station, so we certainly do need help. Any grand plans for the coming year for the station?
Well, this is a slow build. We started this on a wing and a prayer, and it was always clear that it was going to be a long-term endeavor. So I wouldn't say that there are grand plans other than to continue stabilizing what we are doing now and to expand our reach. One of the challenges of Low Power FM is it's getting the word out with 100 watts. And so we're lucky to be working with a group of organizations throughout the Capital Region to promote and expand the coverage of the radio here. And so we're hoping in the next year that our friends at the Green Education and Legal Fund in Albany will be successful at getting their station fully operational, and we'll be able to expand not just from Troy and Schenectady, but also to Albany and reach the entire Capital Region. So that's our goal. We've been working at it for a little while, and I hope by this time next year we will be successful.
Well, thank you, Steve, and congratulations to everyone involved with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the second anniversary, and let's have a great third year. But now we go to news headlines. Political reports that a recent water test near Seneca Lake on a range of toxic chemicals in drinking water was highlighting challenges facing New York regulators in limiting some of these toxins. Water contamination concerns have been a major focus in New York since the discovery of PFOA in the drinking water of nearby Hoosic Falls. While the state is considering limits for PFOA and PFOS, many are concerned that the proposed limits, 10 parts per trillion each, don't go far enough. They also see a need for swifter, more comprehensive actions on a broader range of related chemicals known as PFAS, rather than just looking at each chemical in isolation.
And State Senator Kevin Parker is proposing two bills advancing a universal income for New York residents. One bill would create a pilot program for 10,000 New Yorkers, and the second would establish a feasibility study to look at New York's adoption of statewide program. Parker's bills cap the state funding at $7,200 a year per individual and would be limited based on income.
The controversial New York State Public Campaign Financing Commission heard testimony on Tuesday about how to create a new statewide system of electoral campaign financing that would encourage small contributions and curb the impact of wealthy donors. The recommendations of the commission will become law unless the state legislature convenes a special session in December to change them. Most advocates are pushing for a partial campaign finance system similar to New York City, which uses an 8-to-1 match for small private donations. Critics like the Green Party, however, say the New York City system has not ended the role of large donors, and New York should instead adopt a full public campaign finance system similar to Arizona and Maine. The Assembly Democrats and Republicans, however, are opposed to the use of public funds for campaigns. Media reports focused heavily on the possibility that the commission, under Governor Cuomo's direction, will seek to end the state's use of fusion, which allows candidates to run on multiple lines, a tactic that is critical to the Conservative and Working Families Party. A second hearing will be held in Albany on Wednesday, September 18th.
And Troy's first mayoral debate was dominated by the failure of the city to reopen the swimming pool in South Troy and the cover-up of the police killing of Alessin Thevenin. Participants included Democratic incumbent Patrick Madden, Republican Thomas Real, and third-party challenger, the former city council president, Rodney Wiltshire Jr. Activists who've protested in the last two city council meetings, calling for the secret memo to be released and Sergeant French to be fired, lined one wall of the Lansingburg Boys and Girls Club. They're all holding signs.
John Bolton, the fiery war hawk who served as President Trump's national security advisor, was fired Tuesday due to disagreements over Iran, North Korea, and Afghanistan. Peace activists cheered his departure, noting his strident support for military interventions, including seeking to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela. The ACLU stated that Bolton threatened international criminal court judges and prosecutors for investigating the United States war crimes in Afghanistan. He celebrated when victims of torture were denied the opportunity to hold their torturers accountable. So that's it for news headline here on our second anniversary. Up now, Bronx Climate Justice North held a forum on the Green New Deal at Riverside Church in New York City on Thursday, September 5th. In part one, we talk with Sean Sweeney of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy and Matt Grattan of Earthstrike. We're talking with Sean Sweeney. He's with Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, and he is part of the panel tonight on the Green New Deal at Riverside Church. Sean, what is the union perspective on the Green New Deal?
I think it depends on which unions you ask. Energy unions, the building trades, have been publicly opposed to the Green New Deal, although the reasons why they're opposed should be taken seriously. The more progressive unions in health, public transport, public services have been generally supportive. If passing resolutions or any guide to support or any measure of support, there's an enthusiasm for the idea of a Green New Deal, yes. But it is not... There's no unity across the U.S. trade union movement on this question.
One of the ideas, of course, behind the Green New Deal is that it should be a full employment program. Seems like a lot of unions, however, are skeptical that we're really going to get full employment, particularly at living wage jobs. How can we sort of overcome that, concern that it's not going to be delivered for their workers?
I think it's very similar to the Green New Deal that was floated very briefly by Obama when he was running for president and became part of the international discussion on decarbonization and climate protection. A lot of promises, a lot of numbers. Obama and Hillary Clinton were talking about 5 million green jobs if they became president. One of them did become president, and we didn't get the 5 million green jobs. The jobs that did materialize were nearly all non-union. There are some exceptions to that, but in the renewable sector in particular, it's mostly a non-union industry, and that's a concern. So whether it's jobs or decarbonization goals, whatever it is, there's a very skeptical response normally from some unions.
Now, one of the things I know that you have been advocating for has been the concept of public ownership or democratic control or both, worker ownership of the energy system. We saw Bernie Sanders put out some material recently about that. Howie Hawkins for the Greens had done it for a while. How would you go about promoting that concept of public ownership of energy?
Well, first of all, I think we have to be clear that the alternative has failed. 20 years of mobilize the private sector, incentivize the renewable energy developers, put a price on carbon emissions. All of those policies have been pretty ineffective. In fact, they've been regressive in many respects. So first of all, we have to really put out front that decarbonization, climate protection, the goals of the Green New Deal on climate change alone are not going to be reached unless there's public ownership. So then the second question is, how do we promote it? It would be much better in terms of reaching equity goals, job creation, the speed and scale required for renewable energy deployment, and generally decarbonization of transport, buildings, and industry if it was publicly owned. That's the sort of the basic message.
Now, if people want to find out more about the trade unions for energy democracy, I'm sure you got a website, but what are some of the other key campaigns or issues you are working on at the moment?
We're very involved with the struggle in the UK at the moment to take the electricity sector, the networks in particular, back into public ownership. The Labour Party has taken that position, and we're working with the unions there who are united behind that policy. In South Africa, we're defending public energy from the threat of privatisation, but arguing that the public utility, which burns a lot of coal, should be reformed and restructured, but democratically, but staying within the public field of public ownership.
And people, your website?
It's unionsforenergydemocracy.org, or just Trade Unions for Energy Democracy. Simple search will get you there.
And this has been Sean Sweeney. So next we catch up with Matt Grattan, who's with Earth Strike, and on the student climate strike, we go from September 20th to 27th. So I understand the Earth Strike is particularly focused a little bit more on September 27th. And, you know, what's Earth Strike about, and what are some of your demands?
So Earth Strike is an autonomous member of Earth Strike International. We have demands that are slightly more radical than the international organization. We look to tie the climate crisis into capitalism and colonialism. Mm-hmm. We feel that naming the cause of the climate crisis is crucial. And we see capitalism and colonialism as you know, the main causes of the climate crisis. We are hosting a community strike in Sunset Park, which is an area of Brooklyn that's being gentrified in a pretty harsh way. And we are organizing with a lot of frontline community groups.
So what are some of the specific demands besides replacing capitalism?
Right. So we'd like to... So we have eight demands, actually. I'm not going to list them all, but our main ones include ending climate imperialism. So we don't want, you know... governments and corporations to sort of colonize new lands for resource extraction. We also want to reject eco-fascism. So for instance, in Brazil with, you know, the Bolsonaro regime and the deforestation of the Amazon, those are things that are hazardous to human health and the climate and the environment. So,
How would you compare, say, to, say, Extinction Rebellion? Do they go far enough? They're not anti-capitalist enough? So, I mean, what's the niche? You know, what's the voice that Earth Strike is trying to bring to the table that's not being heard at this moment in time?
We're trying to center the voices of radical frontline groups. So Extinction Rebellion isn't explicitly anti-capitalist, and that's something that we feel is important to name. One of my co-organizers likes to say, you know, like, you've got to sort of like name Voldemort, you know, to make a Harry Potter reference. So we feel like it's, you know, we are going the step further to make the radical demands that other groups aren't making yet. And we see ourselves as sort of tethering, you know, things that are happening more towards the center. And perhaps we are much farther left.
So Bernie Sanders came out recently with his climate change proposal. One thing he sort of added, at least to the Democratic debate, is the issue of public ownership of the energy system. Does Bernie go far enough on public ownership?
I'm not particularly familiar with Bernie's, plan on public ownership, but I certainly, as a citizen, and I think Earth Strike as well, agree with community ownership. In fact, that's one of our demands, is community ownership of public utilities and also of housing.
So on September 27th, Earth Strike is particularly focusing on that day. Understanding that most of our listeners are up in the Capital District, but how can people participate in Earth Strike, and what are, in New York City, what are some of the exciting things you hope to do on that particular day? How are you striking?
how are we striking? We're having a rally in Sunset Park during business hours, of course. And so the idea is that we start the rally in the early afternoon and formally march to a different destination as our protest at 5. So people who get off of work can join us. If people want to from upstate would like to get involved, you should totally take the Metro North down and strike with us.
You got a website, Facebook page, Twitter, Instagram?
Yeah, you can find us on Facebook at Earthstrike NYC, and you can find us on Twitter at Earth_Strike_NYC. We do have a website. It's called EarthStrikeNYC.net.
And this has been Matt Grattan with Earthstrike. This has been part one of a two-part coverage of the Green New Deal Forum down at Riverside Church by Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And that was Sean Sweeney of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, and Matt Grattan of Earthstrike. We'll have the second part of that report on the Green New Deal Forum at Riverside Church on Thursday night.
As we mentioned earlier, tonight is our second anniversary. We started on 9/11 2 years ago. One of our first guests was Kathy Manley, a local attorney, and she had been involved in the case of two gentlemen in Albany who were sent to prison for decades by the FBI after being entrapped in a sting operation involving what the participants thought was a loan for a pizza store. Unfortunately, 18 years later, after more than 3,000 people died, a lot of questions remain unanswered. I recently wrote an op-ed on this and also began to address the issue of how the impacts both here and abroad are still being felt 18 years later.
And Mark, you're someone here who has worked with government politicians and bureaucrats for well over 40 years as a journalist, author, community organizer, activist, and political candidate. What are the issues over the last 18 years that you think are notable that we should be aware of? I know that the White House has just said they're not going to release the documents from 9/11 inquiry. They announced that on the 6th, I think, of September. Is there something strange going on?
Well, one of the big concerns about 9/11 was that it wasn't really designed to convey the truth to the American people about what happened with 9/11. We always say that truth is the first casualty of any war. And in particular, what this was an exercise to sort of protect the reputation and the stand-in of the foreign intelligence community. And so a lot of questions were not answered. We'd never particularly explored the role of the United States starting under Jimmy Carter in destabilizing Afghanistan, which led to the situation where these terrorist camps were allowed to be operate, where allegedly the hijackers flew out of. We never particularly looked at what potential role that countries like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, possibly played in helping the hijackers. But the reality is, and you mentioned this earlier, that this is one of the few moments in my lifetime where much of the world had a lot of sympathy for the United States. And we could have really gone in a different direction and tried to build a world based on more cooperation and really have tried to prosecute this as the criminal act it was. Instead, it was used as, a call for war. And we invaded Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. And we really curtailed civil liberties home and abroad. We've dramatically increased our funding. And reality is, 18 years later, terrorism has actually increased on the planet, and we've seen them spend more and more time going to security at airports.
Well, I know that it quickly became obvious that truth about 9/11 was never to come out. Do you think there's still hope that we'll be able to get some answers, or do you think that the point we need to focus on now is to move forward?
Unfortunately, I don't think we ever going to get answers. And I felt that about 6 months after they started, particularly when they, you know, did that other 9/11 terrorist, Henry Kissinger, who 30 years prior had orchestrated the assassination and overthrow of the democratically elected government in Chile. Surprisingly, the person who the United States has identified as the mastermind of 9/11 has been in custody for 19 years, and apparently they're about to finally, after 19 years, start his trial. The alleged trial will be taking place at Guantanamo Bay. I guess there's some possibility that we could get some additional answers. But I think it's more to, you know, that we as American people have to say, listen, the greatest threat right now to national security, which even increasingly the Pentagon admits, is climate change. And that, you know, rather than spending, you know, $1 trillion a year, spending more money on the military than pretty much the rest of the world combined, you know, we should dramatically cut back and, you know, reinvest that in trying to deal with climate change, not only here in the United States, which clearly is our priority, but we're also responsible for global warming on the rest of the planet, and particularly as the third world countries who had nothing to do with climate change that, in fact, are going to bear the biggest pain from global warming.
I noted that you, right after 9/11, right after only a few hours or a few moments after 9/11, you wrote a statement for the Green Party opposing the bipartisan rush to war. What's happening with that?
Unfortunately, we're still at war. and actually, Bolton, Leslie, was fired partly because, to his credit, one thing that allegedly President Trump wants to do is, after, you know, how many years, 18 years, get the troops out of Afghanistan. He was supposed to actually meet with the Taliban this week, but apparently that's been pushed off. Bad myopics to do it on, 9/11. You know, there hasn't been a very strong peace movement in the United States in, you know, the last decade or so. You know, part of the problem is that there really is a bipartisan effort on both parties to increase funding, for military spending. You hope that that's going to change, especially these young people seem to be becoming more politically active. I don't think their priority is to continue to spend $1 trillion a year to support, you know, military empire across the planet.
And next week there's the climate Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, September 20th is the global climate strike. There is going to be one here in Albany, starting at 11 o'clock, 79 Sheridan Avenue, where the power plant is to power the Empire State Plaza. People want to make sure that we go with renewable energy there and not fossil fuels. Then at 1 o'clock, there's a rally at West Capitol Park. So, you know, people are putting more efforts into climate. But there's also a whole series of rallies in New York City next week about the war issue. Certainly not to go to war with Iran, not to continue to try to overthrow the democratically elected government of, you know, Venezuela.
So we're doing all right as far as being more aware and more alert as a public to find out what's going on and taking part in making statements and giving your voice to things that irritate you, things that are wrong, things like not coming down with the information from 9/11, which, you know, whether or not it's still important. Well, it is important. It is important.
Well, as Steve said at the beginning of the hour, one of the reasons behind, you know, WOOC was really to try to create that alternative media voice. And when we talked earlier about within minutes of the World Trade Center collapsing, not only were the politicians banging the drums of the war, but especially outrageous was the media so loudly saying that we had to go and, you know, attack Afghanistan. And, you know, the problem is in the United States is that much more than many other places in the world, especially democracies, our media is so corporate owned. And increasingly, we, you know, we lay off local journalists. A few corporations own more and more media outlets, and that's why WOC is, you know, so important, is try to give that you know, alternative voice to the media.
What the thing that we want to include the media here in its influence on what's going on in the world, I just have to say that I feel strongly that the late night talk show people were really doing something and had done a great deal about the funding for 9/11 responders' health care.
Right.
And well, that finally went through, even though there was such a big struggle. I mean, 18 right. years it took.
John Stewart from The Daily Show took a yeah. lot of you know, credit for that. I was just reading an article today. 40,000 people have been identified by the official medical center for 9/11 as been
affected.
Become sick
yeah.
by 9/11, included more than 10,000 cancer cases. And it really was outrageous that the EPA and the government, you know, sort of said right after 9/11, oh, don't worry about the toxic air levels. I know we're running out of time. You know, you can go on to GelfNY.org to read a little bit more about some of the questions we still have. But this is Mark Dunley.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Thank you, Mark. Thanks very much. I hope we can continue this conversation another time. Okay, here we go. For those who are just turning in, I'm Andrea, and you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
And next we have Amy Holleran. She's speaking with Elsie Hunter about the sourdough baking and Sourdough September, the international effort to raise awareness of wild yeast baking.
Hi, I'm Amy Holleran, here with another food diary. And today with me is Eliza Hunter, sourdough baker. Welcome, Eliza.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks for coming on. Sourdough September, for people who don't know, is a British concept of education about sourdough to try to get more people aware of what true sourdough is rather than supermarket sourdough. And there's lots of opportunities in the UK and beyond to experience sourdough yourself. Ours is coming up on September 21st at the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market. The whole time the market is open, we're going to have a little sourdough table, and I'm going to be making sourdough English muffins and giving away free sourdough starter and a fact sheet to get you rolling on sourdough. And Eliza, could you please introduce yourself to this great radio land and tell us how you got into baking first and then sourdough baking?
Sure. So I initially got interested in baking because I found that I loved to eat bread, which is probably the way a lot of people start. And so I wanted to learn how to bake the bread. So I started with an internship in New York City at a French bakery, Maison Kaiser. And from there, I was pastry chef at a couple restaurants and then worked at a few other bread bakeries. One of the most recent ones was Berkshire Mountain Bakery in Massachusetts, where everything that they make is sourdough based, even down to their croissants. And so my interest in sourdough really came about mostly because of the flavor. I really loved kind of like the tanginess. And then when I learned that it was a complete wild fermentation of the microorganisms and the yeast that's found in the flour and in the air, that just was like so incredibly cool to me. So I just started trying at home and was baking like 3 loaves of bread every single day in my free time and just really loving it and having so much fun learning about it. So I've been baking bread professionally now for about 7 years. And yeah, and I still am as enthusiastic and passionate about it as I was at the beginning. And there's still so much to learn about it.
Wow. And so where in this 7-year journey did sourdough enter?
In the first year.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. The bakery in New York City, they use a lot of yeast, but they also had a handful of loaves that were all wild fermented, using sourdough starter. So using their pain au levain. And so I think when I was even in New York City commuting an hour, and I was still maintaining my own little sourdough starter at home and baking at home while I was on my days off and, trying to kind of replicate what we were doing at work.
So I'm sure there are people out there who have no idea what it means to maintain a sourdough starter, wild yeasts, all of these things. Can you explain to people what it's like to take care of the fermenting basis, the leavener?
Yeah, sure. It's it can be as labor intensive as you want it or as lax as you need it to be. It's pretty flexible, but the basic process is taking flour and water and mixing them together and letting them sit out, typically at room temperature. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going on a biological and chemical level. And once the mixture starts frothing and bubbling and starting to smell ripe, then you know that you've kind of harvested or you've captured some of these microorganisms that are going to help leaven your bread. And so you need to maintain that starter, because after a certain amount of time, those bubbles are going to deflate and you're going to lose your oomph for your recipe. And so you need to keep adding more flour and water to it on a regular basis. And some people do that daily, some people do it multiple times a day, some people do it once a week. And there's little tips that you can learn to help to figure out how you can fit maintaining the starter into your lifestyle.
Right. So there's tips on weekend baking. I certainly bake once a week, and I keep my starter in the refrigerator during that week. I take it out on a Friday, start feeding it so that by Saturday it's back to its muscular self and it can do the leavening that yeast would normally do. I prefer sourdough baking now because it's kind of like harnessing magic in your house. And once you get, baking with any kind of leavener, baking powder, baking soda, eggs, whipping eggs. It's magic. It's alchemy that we're performing. But there's something really amazing about dipping into the sourdough tradition that is really quite addictive. It's like taking a train and you can't get off.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way. Yeah.
That's great. So do you see, do you have any plans for baking coming up?
Yeah, so right now I'm not currently working for an employer, but I rather am trying to collaborate with some local businesses and farms in hopes to create a community supported baker program. So basically, like once a week, or I would come up with a set schedule, and members would then pick up a loaf of bread or a sourdough pizza crust or some sort of baked good on a weekly basis. And so if I collaborate with, say, a farm who has an existing community-supported agriculture program, then that reaches a broader amount of people to then kind of inform them on what sourdough baking is all about and how you can use it in different ways, and just to kind of know that I am providing really good quality bread that's healthy and tastes great to the community. And that's really important to me.
That's great. And there's a big tradition of CSBs, as they're known, partnering with existing CSAs, because you have a captive audience of interested eaters, and it's a great way for bakers to control their baking and reach an audience.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. So we will reach our audience. on September 21st at the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market. Thank you, Eliza.
Yes, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. This has been Amy Halloran with another Food Diary.
And thanks so much, Amy. That was absolutely delicious.
So up next, Elizabeth Perez was at the first mayoral debate in Troy on Tuesday evening, and she talked with Naomi Jaffe about why the group Justice for the Meek was in a debate calling for justice for Edison Thevenin.
I am here outside the first mayoral debate with Naomi Jaffe from Justice for Domeek, and you're holding a sign, and what did that sign say?
Well, we have three different signs. One says justice for Edson, meaning Edson Thevenin, who was shot by Troy police in 2016. The other one says Mayor Madden and cover up or resign. That's in relationship to the cover up that the city and the police department have had an effect now for since 2016 about the killing of Edson Thevenin. And the third one says no panic defense for killer cops.
That's the one that I want to go a little bit further into right now. What does that sign mean? Can you explain that to me?
Well, the latest piece of cover-up is that after two very careful investigations that showed that Sergeant French, who killed Edson Thevenin, was completely unjustified and jumped out shooting at an innocent person through a windshield, two investigations showed that, and because the city of Troy didn't like the conclusions of that investigation, they paid our good taxpayer money to find somebody that would give them a different conclusion that they liked better. And that, it just came out that the second investigation was hidden, and now this third report is also hidden that the city of Troy paid for and says discredits the earlier reports. That secret report, a leak from that secret report, indicates that what the city of Troy thinks discredits the investigations that show complete malfeasance on the part of the police department in the cover-up and French on the part of killing Edson Thevenin. What the city of Troy thinks excuses that, apparently, is a psychological defense that shows that Sergeant French, or any police officer who does anything, who kills anybody, can claim existential panic. That is, can claim that they were terrified for their lives, even though they shot someone who was completely innocent, completely unarmed, and not moving toward them at the time, and get off. And the second thing that this apparent psychological defense is supposed to show is that police officers can lose their memory in moments of stress, and therefore nothing that they say can be considered a lie because they've forgotten. So we are here to say that that is not a defense for police officers shooting innocent people, because under that defense, any police officer can shoot anybody, and we're not having it.
Thank you, Naomi. So with that, what can, at this mayoral debate, the questions have already been submitted yesterday, but what would you like to see happen or addressed here today?
We'd like to see the mayoral candidates address what they're going to do retrospectively about Edson Thevenin, about the cover-up of the murder of Edson Thevenin, and what they're going to do prospectively about making sure that police officers stop shooting our children in our neighborhoods.
And as the organization Justice for Domeek, who has also been showing up for Edson Thevenin, how can they engage in this topic now?
We are going to continue to show up at wherever the mayor is and wherever the city council is, and we will put out the word so that people can come and join us. We really would like people from all over the Capital District to make it known that it is unacceptable for police officers to shoot innocent people and then the city to cover it up. Sergeant French is still on the streets of our city. We do not want him in our neighborhoods. So we want people to join us in these demonstrations. We really believe that on the street is the place where we can make the most difference here. It's not clear that any of these mayoral candidates are going to do anything different unless we really push them to do it. And the same with our city council. We really have to, as residents of the city of Troy and of the Capital District, we have to be on the street to demand a change. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
Now, we recently on the Hudson Mohawk magazine spoke with Edson Thevenin's mother, Gertha DePass, and in that interview, she called for the firing of Sergeant French. Now, how can we provide more pressure as activists in that call?
We, as Justice for Dominique, are calling for the firing of Sergeant French and also for the firing of Police Officer Eiler, who shot Dominique McDonald, who fortunately survived. That was in the following year, 2017. Again, street pressure is the strongest weapon that we have. Pressure to change the culture of this city and this country, to change the culture that says that police officers can shoot innocent people and get away with it. So that really, it really has to come from an uprising of people, of ordinary residents, being visible and physically heard anywhere where our officials congregate. It's not clear at this point that there's anybody to vote for in this structure that's going to change it unless we put ongoing pressure on them, ongoing visible pressure on them.
Now, in New York City, the officer that shot and killed Eric Gardner was finally fired. Does that process, or do activists look at sort of how that case played out as a model, or is it just way too different?
No, it's not very different. It took a long time and a huge amount of pressure, and it's New York City. In some ways, it shows that the culture is changing very, very slowly, very, very painfully, very little, very late. For example, in the case of Eric Garner, the only person that's in prison in relationship to the case of Eric Garner is the person that exposed the killing of Eric Garner via video. So it'd be better if that cop was in prison, but there is a little bit of change happening slowly. We need it to be more and faster and to spread from New York City to the rest of the country. Definitely it's a model.
And bringing it back to Troy, our city council recently saw this leaked document that you talked about earlier. What is your message to the council members that have already spoken out publicly about that memo?
The council members have to not accept that the panic defense. The council members have to speak out in a way that will prevent this from happening again. If the council members look at this document and say it's legitimate, that the defense, that a psychological defense is legitimate, they are saying that it's fine for cops to come into our neighborhoods and shoot the next kid. So we really need a change on the part of the council members, who do not seem to have taken the side of the people of Troy in relationship to this secret document.
Naomi Jaffe, is there anything else that you want to add today?
We are outraged and angry, and we've been outraged and angry. This is like the fifth or sixth cover-up of this cold-blooded murder. If you read those investigations, you will see that Sergeant French chased after Edson Thevenin to kill him, jumped out of his car and shot through his windshield, jumped in front of Edson Thevenin's car as Edson Thevenin was trying to leave the scene, not trying to aggress against Sergeant French. So what I want to say is that everyone who cares about justice and people's lives needs to be as angry and as outraged as we are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Elizabeth Press, for that interview. Very interesting, and we should all follow through with that. Well, at the annual Labor Day parade in Albany, Willie Terry talks with Wayne Spence, president of New York State Public Employees Federation, and Stephen M. Moquin, president and business agent for the Amalgamated Trans Union Local 1321. Take it away, Willie.
This is Willie Terry, your Roman labor correspondent for the Hustle Mohawk Magazine Network, and I'm here today at the 2019 Labor Day Parade in Albany, and it's Friday, September the 6th, and they got nice weather for a parade.
Yes, they do.
All right. And I have as my guest
Wayne Spence, president of the Public Employees Federation.
And how you doing, Wayne?
I'm doing all right.
All right. All right. Wayne, let me just ask you something. You told me the name of your union.
Yes.
But tell me something about it and the members that they serve.
So we serve the professional, scientific, and technical titles that work for New York State government, from Buffalo to Long Island. Those would be nurses, would be the nurses that works at the SUNY hospitals, SUNY Upstate, SUNY Downstate, SUNY Stony Brook, nurses that work in OPWDD, work in OMH, Office of Mental Health, work in the correctional facilities. engineers who works for the DOT, the scientists that do research that works for DEC, the people who work for fisheries, the people who make sure and manages the state resources when it comes to the forest, parole officer, which I am, research scientists. It's a gamut. We have 3,000 titles in our union, all working for New York State government.
And you cover the entire state of New York, you guys?
Entire state, from Buffalo to Long Island. Now, I live on Long Island.
Now, I see one of the signs over there says that about talking about contract negotiations. Are y'all in contract negotiations?
We are in contract negotiations with the state of New York. Our contract expired in April. We are there hoping to get a fair contract for our members who are citizens, just like everybody else in New York State, but we proudly serve the citizens of New York State.
And Wayne, I know this is your second term for president, right? And I know it's a lot of work, right?
Yes, yes. I kind of looked up the other day and the summer's over and my family say, so when are we going to take that vacation? I was like, oh, well. So I got to go make it up to them before it gets too cold.
Well, I always told me, my wife, she do the refrigerator thing. You know, I had to put your picture on the refrigerator just to remember that you're here.
Yep, my wife said to me, could you pencil me in? I was like, okay, honey, I deserve that. So it's hard work, but it's good work. I love serving the members who in turn serve the citizens of this great state.
Yeah, you gotta love the serve members up. You can't beat it.
Yes, sir.
So, Wayne, in your opinion, how has the labor union fared over the past year? What has been some of their success and failures?
Some of our biggest success has been standing strong after that decision came down from the Supreme Court called the Janus decision, especially within public sector unions. People thought we were going to lose thousands of members, that members were going to actually say, I can walk away from the union and get all the things that the union do for me, which is what you call a freeloader. That didn't happen. For my union, we lost maybe less than 2% of our members. And that has been the average for most unions in New York State. So the good thing is that union is strong in New York still. We are the highest density of any state in the United States for unionized workers. And the public sector workers make up that density. It is state and municipal and county employees who are unionized that make it up. So that has been a good thing for the union movement. What we're not really good at as of late is now that we have to sign people up, they don't come in automatically, telling our story and explaining, especially the young folks, the millennials, the value of the union and why you should be a union person and not be what we call a freeloader. Why you should pay for something that you could technically get for free. And you can't get everything for free because everybody know it might be free today, it ain't gonna be free tomorrow.
And Wayne, so just give me your thoughts on this 2019 Labor Day parade and why it's important that we have things like this.
We got to let folks know what the labor movement's about. We got to let folks know that the 5-day work week never used to be a 5-day work week. People forgot that. People have to remember there was a point in time where children as young as 10 years old used to be working in sweatshops. It was union that got the 5-day work week. It's a union that got certain holidays. It's a union that got to talk about safety. If anybody remember this thing called the Triangle Fire, where hundreds of people got killed in a sweatshop because nobody talked about safety. To this day, safety standards, all those things are generated by the union. It was the union movement, and so we got to keep doing it so people, lest we forget. Because unless you can forget, we're gonna find people getting hurt and getting killed on the job. Because at the end of the day, sometimes that boss only care about the bottom dollar. And somebody gotta speak truth to power. And that's what the union allows every worker to do, speak truth to power.
And Wayne, what are some of the key issues or demand that your union will be fighting for, you know, over the next Labor Day 2020? What things they will be fighting for or things they will fight against?
The biggest thing for us is a fair contract. That recognizes the professional, scientific, and technical titles in state government. Most of our members they have degrees. They're scientists, they're attorneys. And some of them aren't even, we got people who have a PhD in biology, making less than $30,000 a year. A PhD in biology? Right. That's a lot of school. How can you make $30,000 a year coming out of a PhD program with all the loans that's out there and survive? It can't happen. It's not comparable. And if we don't do that, New York State is going to lose that technical expertise that they have, and we're going to start relying on consultants who are going to start doing things based on dollar instead of based on what's the best interest for citizens.
And Wayne, I just want to ask you one last question. I know you got to get back over there. Yeah. If you could give some wisdom to working people about your, you know, your labor experience, coming from your labor experience,
yeah,
what message would you give?
The boss never give you what you deserve. They give you what you negotiate. The boss never on its own give you respect. You have to fight and show and sometimes take that respect. Nothing of value is ever given freely. Think about it. If gold was easy to attain, it wouldn't have value because everybody would have it. Anything of value, anything that's worth having, you got to work for it. And there's always strength in numbers. What one person can accomplish, imagine three or four people were with you, how much more you can accomplish. And that's what the union movement's about.
Okay.
All right.
All right. And there you have it, from Wayne Spence, who's the president of the Public Employee Federation. And thank you, Wayne, for that.
Thank you, brother.
That interview.
I appreciate you.
So Willie Terry's still here at the Labor Day Parade, and it's about to get started. And I have right now as my guest,
Stephen Mulquin.
Stephen Mulquin of the ATU. Now, what's the ATU, Steve?
ATU 1321 is we represent our bus drivers, white collar, and supervisors for CDTA.
And you are the what?
I'm the president business agent.
President and business agent?
Correct.
All right. And tell me some about your union and the members that serve.
We have 612 active members, 238 retirees, and we, like I said, we represent bus drivers, city bus drivers, supervisors, white collar, for city transit buses.
And you cover the Capital District?
We have three boroughs. We do Albany, Schenectady, Saratoga, and Troy.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you a question about the union itself. In your opinion, have the labor unions, how did they fare over the past year? And what do you think was some of their success and failure?
The ATU has not failed. We have grown stronger. Uh-huh. We have a lot of locals. We are one of the biggest. We have locals in Canada, so we're very strong. The failure is Janus Law. Some people feel that they don't have to get in, they want their rights still as a union member. So there's a lot of work we have to get done with the Janus Law.
You mean that Janus Law that was upheld by the Supreme Court?
That's correct.
Right. And that is kind of affecting your union?
It's not. We have a few members, very few members, but most of our members stayed with the union.
Oh, okay.
So we got a handful, maybe four or five of them that did decide they wanted to opt out.
Oh, okay. So. I like the parade is about to start, but I just want to ask you to give me your thoughts on the 2019 Labor Day Parade and why you think it's important.
I think it's an awesome turnout, and we need to show that in the Capital District, this is a union city. So, union strong.
All right, and one last question. If you could give some wisdom based on your experience to working people, what would that message be?
To join a union, be involved. Young people, old people, be out here on days like today, parades. Support the unions. You're only going to get stronger.
Right. It's a nice day. Yeah. All right, there you have it. Words of wisdom from Steve Mulquin from the ATU. The ATU is the
Amalgamated Transit Union.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. It's our second anniversary today. Happy birthday, Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Our engineer tonight was the indomitable Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. You can also get your information through the Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or stop by our weekly meetings on Monday night at 7:07 at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Thanks for tuning in.